All right, so we're continuing on with this great stuff here at YAO 2011. Nigel, thanks for coming on.
It's a lot to be here.
Tell people about sort of what you do these days.
Yeah. YAO's been a great conference, but I've felt like a bit of a fraud because I'm the only guy here who didn't invent a programming language. And I'm probably the only economist at the entire conference as well.
Interesting.
I'm here on the kind of the pulpit of talking about the links between software development and some of the history of other movements, which have been systems thinking and lean thinking. And there's some really interesting links. If you go back in history, the systems thinkers kind of started this game. They go way back until the 1930s, and that was some of the slides we showed yesterday, where the roots of this way of doing software in multidisciplinary teams and in single rooms, working on short time frames and communicating massively, and really pushing to get something out in a day or a week, not 6 months, which was traditional for software teams. We traced that back to the 30s, and that's kind of what the company I work for now does. I have a little company called Lunar Tractor, based in Melbourne, and we're just kind of coaching and talking and doing kind of anything that product development side is really fascinating to us. Software development, not so much, because neither of us are software developers, really. But we do love the kind of the human side and the team side and the performance side, which mostly the insights come from Toyota, the Japanese approach to kind of quality and product, and older stuff than that from the States. So
interesting.
That's
now,
what we do.
You have an interesting history with Lonely Planet.
Yeah,
tell us about that.
A great company. So a company really, a good example of the world of business models changing dramatically. So I often quote the, you know, people get an idea that you build a business, you're going to pass it to your grandchildren. And that is so rare that, of course, we all live this lifetime and we kind of assume the companies that are important and famous to us have lasted all of our lives and will continue to last all of our lives. So I often ask, you know, in my kind of talks and motivational stuff, I ask, of the Fortune 500 that existed in 1960, say, how many exist today? I mean, and people either go one way or another. They kind of get the idea that, oh, it's maybe not going to be a big number. But only 70 companies exist after 50 years.
Wow.
And that was an era in history that where if you had an idea of how to make money, it probably did last between 35 and 50 years, and you would pass it to your children. Maybe your grandchildren, and then your grandchildren kind of faced all these changes in society and human demand and where they lived and the technology they used in their tastes and in their expectations. And so a lot of people have screwed some pretty long-standing business models in the last 10 years. But the real shock of it is the new business models that are emerging, you know, the Googles and the Yahoos and in Australia businesses like Seek, Census, who in 2000 were creating massive disruption. So you look at what, say, Seek did to the newspaper's revenue from the hiring columns. You know, you ask a 22-year-old about column inches in a newspaper for hiring, they'll just look at you like you're insane. You know, what, you used to publish lists of jobs in the newspaper? I mean, what a stupid idea. Because they'll only, you know, they'll look on Seek and, you know, Seek has absolutely disrupted the all millions of revenue earned by the newspaper business. It has monstered it in the United States. And yet now, here, you know, 10 years later, they're being brutally disrupted by LinkedIn and social networks because someone clicked that actually all they'd done was taken the paper listings and put them in HTML and charged a little less for them, but not particularly. So it wasn't a massively different business model. They just kind of stole the revenue out of Fairfax and out of, you know, the Washington Post and everyone and you know, Murdoch and all his mates, those kind of things.
Yeah.
What something like LinkedIn does with recruitment now, their revenue's gone from nothing to $150 million on recruitment in a couple of years.
Wow.
Globally. They've got a much more effective model. They just say, hey, do you know anyone? So instantly, they're hooking into what Zuckerberg called the social graph, which is, you know, if I really respect your work, I'll say, hey, look, I know this guy, and he's kind of in that field, and I've worked with him once before. He was pretty good. You should talk to him. Something completely different has happened, as I have attached my warranty to you, to this guy looking for a job, because I'm not going to do it if I think you're going to let me down. Yeah. And then it's this triple kind of relationship, this triangle goes on where, man, I recommended you, so you don't want to let me down.
Yeah.
And the employer's kind of holding me a little bit accountable, and there's no money needs to change hands here. So just getting the profile to that opportunity. And so, damn, you know, those 2001 business models that we all applauded when, you know, I went to California and joined the gold rush, and we thought we were building things for 50 years. We thought we'd disrupted our dads and grandfathers for a long time. Mm-hmm. God damn it, the kids are disrupting us now.
Yeah.
And nothing's going to last more than 7 years.
7 years.
7 years is the life of a business model today.
Really?
And that is exactly what BitLonely Planet is. After 37 years, started in 1973 in Melbourne, and became the world's most prolific travel publisher. After that time, you know, when I joined in April 2007, I joined at a time they'd had a really big problem implementing a tech project, which cleanups are kind of one of my specialties. So I'd gone in to clean that up, and then learned dramatically about the disruption to their business that was going on. Now, when I arrived, you know, they had a business plan. They said, okay, well, this is what we were trying to execute. We were trying to get a website with lots of ads on it and, you know, grow our digital revenue. The book revenue's okay, but it's kind of flattening out. People are traveling a bit different, but everything's cool. We only change the books every 5 years, and, you know, everyone's used to it. And they love them. They tell us they love The Lonely Planet. It's a travel Bible.
Absolutely.
And so April 2007, there's a lot of things didn't exist. So there was no iPhone. There was no iPad, there was no Kindle. I got one of the first Sony e-readers that year and went, oh man, this is so horrible to use. This will never amount to much. And Twitter was 6 months old by then and was kind of like, this is freaky. This is not as good as SMS. You know, it's like SMS, but dumb and not personal. So we didn't think that would work much either. And Facebook had 20 million or so members, and we were pretty certain it wasn't going to do anything to MySpace. So the business model we were building was built around, you know, a plan that was only a couple of years old. It was from 2005, where you could make a lot of money putting ads on your website. We had a lot of people coming to Lonely Planet's website because they loved the books. And every time we got an idea, it was so long to execute it that you just didn't get it into production before something disrupted you. And, you know, people don't use a book anymore. They can literally go somewhere and do a Twitter search geographically or ask a Twitter question. I did it yesterday. I mean, I come to Brisbane. I rarely come here. I'm a coffee snob of the highest order. I'm going, oh, my God, it's a mall. Where am I going to find coffee in a mall downtown Brisbane? I don't know the place at all. So a quick check of Twitter, and there it is. Someone recommends this little place down an alleyway called Brew. It's 100 meters from the hotel. I would never have found it. It wasn't in a Lonely Planet guide because it's brand new. I go there, and what do? I take a photo, and I tweet it. So, you know, the entire conference here now knows about that place. There's people. I've been watching people walking in and out of it from the conference for 2 days.
Interesting.
And that is how travel is working today. So, poor Lonely Planet, it needed a way of working that was much shorter cycle, much more adaptive and iterative. It was fascinating because the IT community weren't talking agile there. The board of directors were talking about a way of working where they no longer handed over like $5 million to a group of people who thought they had a vision that they could execute over 3 years. The board was in their frustration talking about, damn, why didn't we kind of give you 200,000 and 3 months to make a little website that just covered New Zealand? And then if you figured out what the customers wanted on New Zealand and add bits in and take them out, expand it to Australia. And listen to customers and use small chunks of money and do that. And they'd been persuaded by kind of the last generation of old school technologists that Big Bang was the only way. So they'd done e-commerce. They'd done a photo library. They'd done an enterprise content management system. They'd done a website. And just to round it off, they built an ERP system based on SAP as well and automated their supply chain. They bought every SAP module available to mankind. And they did all that in parallel and all at once. And they would never do that twice. They kind of fast learners. So they knew that was a screw up. They were talking in this agile way, and I'd come back from the States, gone back to New Zealand for sort of living in semi-retirement, picking up a whole new field of work, which is always interesting to learn. And the opportunity came to go to Melbourne and try and fix that. And I didn't know. I knew they wanted to be agile, but I only found out on day one that it had basically put them so far financially under, and their morale was now so low that the shareholders were looking for a partner to sell to.
Wow.
And fortune smiled upon them with the BBC coming along. Similar culture, plenty of money. And, you know, that being able to resource up made us quite a quick change. And a bizarre thing happened. We kind of taught the IT people to work in this short cycle, agile way with stand-ups, and, you know, it used to look pretty weird. It used to look like a series of prayer meetings around the floor. It's a very open plan kind of space. And the other people started to notice this happening. And it only took one or two of these other people who don't traditionally work this way. And my famous example is lawyers. You know, you combine smart people and a smart way of working, you will not believe the results you get. And lawyers are, you know, very traditional. You know, was it prostitution and lawyers? They fight over who's the oldest trade in the world. One might have led to the other, maybe. And they certainly both use each other's business models. So it was incredible. They had a set of business problems that read a lot like not software business problems, but where lean and agile came from. Concerned about quality, concerned about the cycle time of getting stuff turned into cash. Smart people, knowledge workers, that's exactly where this sort of work process is making the most difference. So I left earlier this year, unfortunately, still struggling to make money with the continued decline of retail. You know, a significant percentage of their retail distribution has walked away every year for the last 2 years. Barnes and Noble struggled, Borders gone. You know, the high street of the UK is just devastated in terms of book retail. So you've got it's just a terrible situation where the technology is changing and customers are demanding it on Twitter. And the cost of production of books is still the same. Nobody wants to lug a £2 Lonely Planet guide around anymore. And nobody had the money under the financial crisis to go for 2 months. So the biblical Lonely Planet guide was perfect for like a month or a long holiday. You could plan for ages with it, take it away with you, and that was cool. But the consumer behavior changed because everyone put their credit cards back in their pockets and just didn't want to travel for 2 months or 3 months. They wanted to keep their job. You know, the Americans never had that luxury anyway. You know, maybe 8 days vacation a year. So they always did short trips. And when we started applying the kind of agile stuff to product development at Lonely Planet, it really clicked and made sense. So it's that passion for listening to real customers, not some guru, editorial product guy. You really show the product to a real customer and ask them what they think. And that cemented it into the culture as this is a really good way to go. Because some of the product development life cycles went from 2 years to 8 months. And they'll now innovate a product series, so like a country guide or a city guide. They'll just block themselves out. We're going to do this in 3 months. And the leap of faith occurred when the teams knew any ideas they didn't get to would get picked up next year when they revisited that product. So the whole competitive advantage of Lonely Planet went from encyclopedic content, which you now get on Twitter, Facebook from your friends, and books to some extent, e-books particularly, to being able to innovate product quickly. And it took until the first time people saw the ideas they didn't get to in a shorter development life cycle being picked up again the next time they picked that book up for a bit more innovation. It took, that was the leap of faith. And they saw that, oh man, well that idea will get picked up again. So many projects, particularly IP projects, you'll find product people jamming everything into that first release. Because we all know phase two is code for never going to happen. And in Agile, there's always a phase two and a phase three and a phase four. And it was a very successful story, apart from the fact that it just was too costly to run in Australia. And this, having a British shareholder was severely penalising us because we had 80% of our costs in Melbourne and 80% of our revenue in the UK, Europe, and America in the wrong currencies. So, you know, Jim Webber today talked about, I mean, it's costing him £6 for a coffee, basically.
Wow.
Because the exchange rate has halved from where it was. And so our profits returning back into the pounds were awful. If we had an overrun of costs in a year, they had to reach into their pocket for twice as many pounds to help cover it. So it was the only sensible thing to do, and an incredible opportunity to move into in with the BBC in London, because they had, they're moving all their TV people to Manchester.
Okay.
So a little less pressure on their real estate. Halved the team size, got it down, and got it really focused. So we kind of, it's really bad for Australia that an innovative, agile technology group has had to move to London. But it's kind of, it's not too bad for Lonely Planet, who's given them another set of, another bit of breathing room to kind of think and innovate and keep moving forward. But
interesting. So, I mean, for people, I mean, I'm not really, I don't follow agile and that kind of stuff. I mean, I focus mainly on, you know, the technology sort of stack, which of course, it's good to be agile and to write software you can release quickly, know what your customers, I mean, the business model and the software model, they're sort of the same here, right?
Yeah.
Listen to the people using your software, get your stuff out quicker, iterate. But when you don't necessarily have any, I mean, nobody saw Facebook coming, nobody saw Twitter coming, nobody saw Google coming, nobody saw, I mean, I could go on and on and on and on.
Yeah,
how do you deal with that?
Groupon.
Exactly. So how do you, how can you be agile, not just in planning and delivering, so planning and execution, but in anticipation and betting?
Yeah. Well, you have to become brilliant listeners. You have, it's like, the best metaphor I've seen is you need, it's like the old days, you had to monitor the radio frequencies. And that's essentially what you have to do today, is you have, you know, the long-term roadmap's fairly obvious as to where this is all going. It's more and more mobile. It's more and more services online. And not at a great transaction cost. So you've got your targets and your parameters of where you're going. And it's really just listening to the signals now. And you know, the fortune is that there are blogs. You've got to be, learn to listen to the tweets. You've got to just manage the space and not commit to three-year plans. So this is the massively disruptive thing to the 50-year-old CEOs of companies who think five-year plans are cool. You commit to three-month plans. Now, no CFO who's done an MBA at Harvard is ever going to get comfortable with the fact you've got a three-month business plan. And you can have a roadmap that says, well, we're in this field and we're going to do this cool stuff for customers over this period of time. But don't bother planning over 3 months, because the rate of change is now phenomenal. And I think there's some really great metaphors. I mean, from the media industry, the newsroom. Newsrooms have been assembling news stories in priority order on a daily basis for 40 years. They're actually damn good at it. And adjusting that order and doing another iteration for the 9 o'clock half hour segment. And if you, and I will often find talking to media people that that is, they've got exactly the sensibilities required today in product development, because they know about working short cycles, making quick decisions, going, you know what, if we make the wrong decision for the 6 o'clock news, and that story gets trumped by another one because there's lots of viewer interest and calls, we'll swap them around for 9 o'clock. And so media does know about how to do this.
Sure.
And the, and I think from the other side, I mean, this part of the secret of Lonely Planet was a tremendous investment in the underlying hardware and all of those physical things that can constrain you being very flexible in this kind of, you know, the atoms layer, the electrons layer that the guys here at this conference talk a lot about with software, which is very changeable and manipulable. If you're really smart, you'll teach these ways of working to the underlying systems people as well. And you'll use the same principles. You'll entrust them, you know, you'll give them the autonomy and mastery and purpose. That is lots talked about for software developers. You'll give that to your infrastructure guys as well. So that's all invisible though. So you know, Lonely Planet, we did the same approach with some brilliant and committed young engineers. We said, look, this is what we're trying to do. This is why we're trying to do this. Here's a pile of BBC money. You know, build it like it was yours. And keep close to your customers who are these guys, because you have to make a site that serves 40 million pages a month anywhere in the world. So you're going to need to understand some pretty cool technologies, because if you get that many hits on just a plain old server, you will crash it every time. And that was very, you know, that was very exciting for them, not being told, hey, we want you to run these kind of servers, and it's got to run on this system with this caching and Akamai of this service. Just say, hey, look, here's why we want to do this, and here's what we want to do. You figure out how. Here's $2 million.
Nice.
And $2 million sounds like a lot of money, but I tell you, it was a fraction of what had been spent to put them in the trouble.
I'm sure.
And then you just, you get all the discretionary effort and talent out of people. You get the very, very best out of people. And that's merged in the last year or so. There's a new kind of practice called DevOps, where those to the traditional hated communities, you know, the positive and the negative, the operational people and the developers, cowboy developers and conservative operators who don't want to change anything.
Mm-hmm.
Someone's worked out how to link that, and that's the next generation of Agile, is having them all on the same team.
Agreed.
And in that kind of newsroom environment, that is an Agile team. And that's really creating an opportunity to reduce the risk on projects, because you know, you don't buy everything you need to fulfill the 1 year, 5 year plan. You buy as much as you need to get to the next month, 2 months. You can change your mind.
Yeah.
And this disruptive stuff keeps coming along. I mean, Groupon, I would have laughed at you if you said Groupon was a good idea. Launched, massive IPO.
Crazy.
Who knows? I guess we all just wish we'd invested in it, you know?
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, but you never know. That's the thing. And then there's, of course, the people who just didn't, like you said, they didn't see it coming. Now, the question I have for Agile and sort of the fractal Agile that you're talking about, where it's from the systems guys up to the CEO, everybody's on the same page.
Yeah.
That actually, in and of itself, presents a pretty hard problem, depending upon the size of the organization. So you could have 100 engineers trying to ship some code, ship some product, who may not necessarily understand what the strategy of the company is for the next 2 years, or the competitive pressure, or what's going on in the boardroom. Because, of course, most of us don't know whatever goes on in a boardroom. But let me ask you that. What, you know, developers are smart.
Sure.
And they're very opinionated. And so, and I know for a fact, when you're developing a product and you're having a meeting with the feature program manager and the tester and the dev, we all have our opinions. And so how can you maintain Agile when everybody is going to have an opinion? Somebody has to be a leader, is my point.
Sure. That's one of the fundamental mistakes people make around Agile, that it's some kind of hippie democracy. So the classic Lonely Planet thing was, people come in, and we love doing tours. I still do tours. They very kindly gave me the keys to the castle to take people back.
Nice.
For a look. And people think, oh, yeah, well, a bunch of hippies like Lonely Planet, I mean, maybe 2/3 of the staff wear shoes on a daily basis. It attracts the people just like you imagine to the brand. And that's what makes it special. But they didn't get into this because it was kind of a hippie thing to do and it's naturally a fit to their culture. They got into it for brutal commercial reasons. You know, everyone has to know what's going on. You have to know the strategy. You have to know the purpose. You have to know the why. It's not just Agile. I think anything that involves knowledge work, you need to... there's a guy called Simon Sinek, does this great... It's on YouTube. A TED Talk about... The great storytellers have always told their story with the why first. And it's a great executive trait to be able to explain why you're doing something. Steve Jobs is brilliant at it. Why you're doing it, and maybe leave the how out. Let the people decide how they're going to do it. And then talk about, well, yeah, you get down to the next level. Some product managers are going to say what. The fundamental lesson is, Agile is not a democracy. There's no votes on which product features go up. And probably the highest turnover at Lonely Planet in the last 4 years will be people who were put on the spot to prioritize product decisions and lead. Because it sounds like it's a really hippie and easy thing to do, but there is nothing tougher than being in front of a standing up group of smart, curious, particularly software developers, mouthy, Gen Y, opinionated young guys and girls, who will absolutely question whether that's the right priority to do that or whether that's a good idea for customers or not. And they'll openly ask, well, hey, which customer did you ask that said that was a good idea? And this is the real crisis of Agile. It's finding people who are tough enough to lead that. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people you can get to do the development because it's a fun place to work as a developer. There's a lot of people you can get to glue teams together and keep them all working together. They used to be business analysts, mostly. They've kind of got that brain. Mm. The shortage is in actually brilliant product leaders. And that's where a lot of the dysfunction of Agile comes out, when people start substituting other things in. Mm. You start substituting a marketing department in for talking to real customers. So let's pretend I'm the customer as a way of solving arguments. Mm. The solution to that at Lonely Planet was we got the Nerf guns out and that person was nerfed mercilessly. That is a dumb thing to say, and it's a real sign of a breakdown in the system somewhere along the way. And people hate making decisions because it's kind of like, oh my God, what if I make the wrong decision? It'll be career breaking and people will think I'm an idiot, I'll be embarrassed.
Yeah.
The counter to it is, you know what? Whatever decision you make, we can undo that in a month or a week. We'll let it run for a week and we'll learn it. Mm-hmm. In the old way, you made a product strategy decision for a year, you'd come back at the end of the year and go, oh man, that was the dumbest idea ever, you know, and now Google's come in with a competing product and you never run more than a month without having a retrospective and talk about it. And the really highly functional teams, you know, I think someone described at the conference and it was like a fair fight, basically, where you've got to be intellectual enough to put up with that debate. But our people very much know it's not a democracy and a decision will be made and they'll follow it. They might get a chance to have their say, but they sit down and try and make it work. But there, no democracy in Agile. There's no votes and people often make that mistake.
Do you think something like Agile could work at, you know, like the company like Microsoft?
Absolutely.
I mean, we have like pockets of, I mean, the dev team, for example, on Channel 9, it's just a crack team of devs. There's only five of them, really excellent developers, very productive. They know who they are. But, you know, that's one thing. Then there's groups that actually ship billion lines of code.
Sure.
How could you build agility into a workforce of, let's say, 5,000 developers?
Sure. I mean, you've got to go back to the original lean, the big industries, the Toyotas, and how they built these teams. Because it kind of screws your org structure to some extent. You no longer have department handing off to another department. So you don't have the business analysts handing off a gated piece of signed off requirement structure to developers who finish it, hand it over to the testers to find fault in it, who hand it over to the subject matter experts, who hand it over to the marketers. Who hand it over to the kind of release guys, and that breaks. You're talking about teams constructed through that. And one of the biggest barriers is that there's no longer the chief BA, so that job goes off the chart. Mm. Oh man, where's the career path for business analysts now? You don't have enterprise architects. Mm. Now, at large scale, you start to bring some of that stuff back in. And it's just about rethinking your organization. You might have 20,000 people and they're currently organized into analyze, design, build, test, implement, and support. You take those 20,000 people and build them into teams looking after stuff. The only challenge becomes coordination and people running over each other with changes. And a block of code supporting a Microsoft Word, for example, it's going to be a little bit harder. And you know, in some ways Microsoft does continually release because they're continually patching the products that they've got, and then you get a major release over time. I'm not sure whether Microsoft could pull it off culturally. You know, they have a massively competitive culture. It is about excellence and it is about achieving as an individual. Maybe they can't pull it off, but Google, I mean, Google's much smaller, richer, but Google uses an agile process. It gets down to focus on the customer, what's their problem, how can a product solve that, and which team can put that together and make it work, just like your team's doing. It can scale up considerably. You know, there's quite an element of Agile at Facebook. And it comes right down to releasing small increments often. I think the Microsoft model is still constrained by the shrink-wrapped software thing, where you've got to do a big release every 2 years and give it another number, and that's That is a real dilemma. I don't think, say, Microsoft could have pulled off what Apple just pulled off with iOS 5. Mm.
Well, the thing about, well, I mean, I would say that in terms of Apple, when they do operating system releases, they're not really concerned with backwards compatibility, whereas, and what I mean by that is if you upgrade from OS X to, say, the next one, there's an explicit guarantee that things are going to break, and that's just the way it is.
Yeah, and there's a certain amount of goodwill from the consumers about that. I don't know. I mean, Microsoft has become so embedded in the enterprise for corporations, you know, from, and we all forget the brilliance of Microsoft is beneath the water on the iceberg. Mm. Exchange. All the things that so many corporations rely on running really solidly. Mm-hmm. The actual applications, you know, Word, Excel, those kind of things, are just so underutilized. I think that's allowed a lot of people to come in and eat their lunch, you know, Google Docs, those kind of things around simpler applications that actually work for what customers require. And that's the lesson Lonely Planet learned about its books. There was way too much stuff in there. Mm. Customers weren't using it, and they were brave enough to go, we'll re-engineer that product and throw stuff away.
Interesting.
Put the investment into better maps, for example. It costs a bit more because they're color, but okay, we'll chuck that out that nobody actually looked at. And that was the opportunity missed, I think, by Microsoft in the last decade, was really listening to customers about what it wanted in Microsoft Word. If they'd done that, they would have come up with a much lighter version. Hmm. They would have served it on the cloud, and they'd have won. Now they've let in all of these other players, and it's really sad because, you know, Microsoft, one of the heroes of my generation. Hmm. You know, I remember Windows. I remember Windows being introduced. It changed the world of computing. And then they got stuck in that mentality. And, you know, the famous stories that are told and retold among the agile circles of the days that engineers did go to Ballmer and, you know, before him Gates with ideas. And they were screamed at and told, that it is probably an apocryphal story about, you know, do you want to fuck Windows? Do you want to be the guy who fucked Windows?
Yeah.
And, I mean, I think that's the way innovation works, is somebody has to be the guy mm-hmm. that eats their own. Mm-hmm. And they fell for the same trap. The Bill Gates business model was believed it was going to last 50 years. He'd hand that to his children and his grandchildren, and on it would go. Mm-hmm. And it's just not going to. And it's so unbelievable. It's so unbelievable to believe that a lonely planet will disappear off the face of the earth. It's so unbelievable to think that a Microsoft will disappear off the face of the earth. Mm. Or that a Google will. Mm-hmm. Or a Facebook. But you've got to believe it. You've got to believe that's possible and start working in these timeframes where consumer behavior and technology are so disruptive. And economic conditions are so disruptive that level of change can happen.
Agreed. And on that note, since that sort of brought us back to the beginning, thanks for coming on and sharing your wisdom with us.
Thank you.
Very interesting stuff.
Yeah, I got these gray hairs the long way around. So
yeah, right on, man.
I love to share.
Right on. Well, hey, thanks for coming on Channel 9.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.